and welcome to the More Than Books podcast. I'm your host, Joel, as usual, and I'm joined, as usual, by...
It's me, it's Jake.
And today, we're going to talk about the maker movement. Things like Raspberry Pi projects.
And like laser printers.
3D printers.
Right.
All that fun stuff.
Hacking stuff. Tearing circuits out of robots.
Making drones and racing drones.
Oh man, have you seen the drone racing that now exists? Like it's got a camera mounted on the drone.
And the people wear the headsets.
And people wear virtual reality headsets that are tied into the video on the drone.
I think we kind of talked about this in our last podcast.
Oh just yeah, briefly. We did. Yes.
But it is, and if you haven't listened yet, you should check it out.
That's right.
Technology Trends for 2017 podcast.
Episode 21.
Yeah, but drone racing's awesome. I've seen some videos. It looks like Star Wars, going through the trees on the speeder bikes.
I am 100% certain I would throw up if I did it.
Yeah, I'm sure motion sickness is definitely a thing that happens with those.
It has to be. Real bad. You got to get your... You know, I've heard a number of people talk about... This is a little off topic, but I've heard some people talk about virtual reality, how you have to get sea legs, essentially. Like, you have to get your virtual reality legs.
Yeah, you have to get used to the motion or the movement or the feeling of movement without actually moving. I guess it really messes with your balance and your inner ear. The way your body perceives motion and movement,
which is how people get motion sick.
Yeah,
like that is the whole way. That is exactly how people get sick. And I it's only happened to me like a couple times, and it's usually if I'm playing a game that's like first person and something doesn't feel quite right, then I might get a little motion sick. But drones and laser cutters and 3D printers, all this stuff, it really comes down to the fact that we are starting to get the tools, like technology is advanced enough, where we can kind of make our own stuff.
And things are cheap enough now. I mean, we have computers that you can get, like, boards with everything on it to make these things that cost $10, $15, like... much cheaper than it used to be, which opens up a lot of doors for home projects.
And it may sound, I mean, I think to some people, the makerspace movement, which if you don't know what the makerspace movement is, it's essentially a technology-based movement where people are creating and prototyping their own technologies using kind of hobbyist materials. And then some people utilize that to create it into bigger projects and potentially even commercial-based projects that they can sell then. But the maker space concept is there's nothing new about it. Like, I can imagine that if my ancestors in the 1800s could see what the makerspace movement is, they're just like, that's real life. We make all of our own furniture because we have to, because that is what you do?
Oh. I mean, it has more of a hobbyist kind of vibe now,
yeah.
I think. But
it's not survival based. I have to make my own clothes because I have no other way to wear clothing.
And a lot of, you know, where libraries come into this is a lot of libraries are starting to offer makerspace areas. But then there's also, I've heard of libraries offering like power tools and things like that, like a tool library for their patrons to come and use, because not everybody can afford the nice expensive tools. So having a place where they can go and borrow them if they need something.
It's
incredibly useful.
Yeah, really, really nice. I mean, and there are places, there are for-profit, like, hardware stores that will rent you tools.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, municipal governments are allowing their libraries to offer these services to their patrons, I think is really important to helping people save money and do what they need to do.
Yeah. And even nonprofit, like there's a place in Omaha called Bench, and it's a workshop area that is, it's a nonprofit. They have work areas, they have tools, you can come in and join and use their stuff. So if you want to be a carpenter but live in an apartment, you can just go and have this space to work.
I think really close to Bellevue University is a just a like rentable garage to work on your car. So if you, you know, like I know it's really common for like people that live in apartments, oftentimes the only way they can really work on their vehicle is if they rent a garage themselves, but then they're kind of limited in space because usually those are single car garages and they're not great. Or they have to do it like on the sidewalk, you know, they have to do everything in the parking lot, which
and I know on my lease there's a thing that says that I'm not allowed to change the oil in my driveway or anything like that.
Oh yeah, no, yeah. It's really common that they limit that stuff. So the fact that a business has opened up their particular facility for people to be able to do that stuff, I think is really smart. I'm going to have to assume it's not terribly expensive to rent that space.
I don't know the pricing, but I don't think so. I think you might have to like become a member and there might be like annual dues.
Oh yeah.
That kind of thing.
That makes sense. And then you have to like, you have to reserve space and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I haven't looked at it cause I don't know anything about vehicles. But what I do know is I recently, for a recent holiday, received a Raspberry Pi 3. And the first thing I decided, or I knew exactly what I was going to do with it, is I wanted to turn it into a arcade and video game emulation box.
Now, what is a Raspberry Pi, Jay?
Yes.
Is this like a nice fruit dessert? I love asking questions that clearly we know the answer to, because it's just a nice way of getting a conversation going.
Okay, dum-dum. Raspberry Pi.
What's a Raspberry Pi?
It's a delicious treat. No, it's a small, inexpensive computer that runs typically anywhere, depending on the model, can run anywhere from about $15 all the way up to $40. And they have varying degrees of power, but they allow people to do programming projects or integrated at really any project that would require a computer of some sort to do processing, it can be used in that project. It is just a tiny computer.
Okay.
So for my project, it was loading it up with a custom software that you can find online that has, it's really, really impressive on the how the software and how nice of a presentation the front end of the software is. Essentially, all of the icons and how you're able to go through the menus, all of that is really, really professional looking and surprising with almost no work. I just loaded up the very basic version of it, and it has a lot of ability to customize. And so what this software allows me to do is to play copies of old video games that I may or may not own.
Okay, or maybe they're out of print. Maybe
some of them
in
are
public domain.
There are really no video games that are in public domain, unfortunately. Some of them have been abandoned by their companies because the company is no longer in existence and no one necessarily owns the rights. But it is incredibly rare for anything to really go that direction. The problem with this is that, yes, the company's software and code has copyright. There are multiple cases that cover that copyright. What I am doing is in a somewhat legal gray area, because there is, for many of these games, there is no way to legally purchase this game, even in a digital format.
Well, and we kind of talked about that in our one of our podcasts, you know, the one about the Internet Archive.
Yes.
We got into that abandonware and
yeah, they have a lot of arcade software that they, and that's actually where I got my arcade stuff for this system, is from the Internet Archive.
So what you basically made a home video game console.
That essentially, yes.
That runs ROMs, like has an emulator on it, but it's kind of a plug and play thing. It has a custom OS on
and
it, I'm
for,
assuming.
Yes, it does. Yes, so, which is based on a distribution of Linux, which is essentially a version of Linux called Debian, which has been modified again to run very streamlined on the Raspberry Pi, which then has been, of course, renamed to Raspbian. Yeah. So it's layers on layers on layers on layers as far as the software goes, because in the background is Raspbian, And then on top of that is emulation software. And then on top of the emulation software is this nice front-end software that makes everything look nice and neat. And like the graphics are good. It's really easy to use. It's easy to manipulate.
Is it controller-friendly?
It's very controller-friendly. Like, as a matter of fact, you really very rarely do you ever need to use a keyboard. So all of that combined makes for a really great package. I got to play a lot of interesting stuff. I got to play some things that I have never been able to play before. Specifically, TurboGrafx-16 CD games that never made it to the United States.
Interesting.
Japan only. I mean, not that we're going to spend a ton of time on this, but the TurboGrafx-16, for those of you that don't know, was a video game system that released shortly after the NES, kind of between the NES and the Genesis. And it's weird because it's essentially a system that is power-wise is two NESs stacked on top of each other.
Hmm.
It has two 8-bit processors instead of a single 16-bit processor. So graphically, it looks like a super, or not super, because that's a different thing, a souped-up NES that is able to have more colors and a little bit better graphics. But it's not that much better than an NES, which is interesting. And its games, instead of coming on like large plastic cartridges, came on these little cards that you slid in. They're called Hue cards.
Hmm.
But it was also the very first home console that could run CD-ROMs. And so there are about 40 or 50 CD-ROM games that came out, and roughly about half of them are worth playing. So I got to play a version of Castlevania that's really cool. The big draw for those games is that it has like slightly enhanced NES graphics with a really, really great CD quality sound. So it's this weird dichotomy of like there's voice acting, and I mean a lot of it's in Japanese, so it doesn't really have much of an impact, but there's voice acting and there's sound and music and all this stuff on there, and then I'm playing essentially an NES game. So there's a weird novelty in that.
Yeah, whereas, you know, most of the actual Nintendo old school Nintendo games I played had very tinny music, what do you call it, MIDI?
Well, basically, no, they had the NES actually has a built-in synthesizer, so it is synthesizing the sound. The Super Nintendo used a sampler, and so that's why some people think that the Super Nintendo sounds a little bit better. That sampling chip was made by Sony, which of course they were supposed to make that into like a CD console as well. There's a whole big, we don't have enough time for sure.
That'll be a different podcast.
That's a
topic
totally, yeah, we may.
We'll get into the history of video games.
We may do a history of video games podcast to talk about some stuff, but that doing this project has allowed me to access stuff that is difficult to get to run on like mass computers. Like I probably could find the software and get it all to run, but because that software is tailored for that computer, and as long as it has the power to run this stuff, it runs it very well. Maybe not 100% accurate, but it runs it well enough that I can't tell the difference.
Well, I know here in the library, we actually do use a Raspberry Pi to run our digital display. So we have a slideshow on a TV in the library, and it just shows like upcoming workshops. It shows current events. And that's literally just a Raspberry Pi plugged into an HDMI port, and we just update it, put new images on it, and just run it as a slideshow.
And we initially got the Raspberry Pi because we thought that we would be able to access it through our virtual network, that we were going to actually network the device wirelessly to our computers, and so when then someone needed to change the pictures that were running in it, they would just use software to essentially log into it and place the picture and then run it with the new picture. So we would be able to update it in theory remotely from wherever we were. Like the Raspberry Pi has this capability. The problem, of course, is that the Raspberry Pi, as far as security wise, because I over time I've asked friends of mine that are in network administration, and they have actually told me that Raspberry Pis are very insecure. There, you can make them more secure, but they're difficult to manage, and it's more of a headache than I think most network admins really want to deal with.
So, yeah, we keep ours off the network for that reason. It's still a cool little project that we did. It's a very cheap solution. It might be an inelegant solution, but
a little bit of an inelegant solution, unfortunately. Works. But yeah, but it does work. And you know, it's really, if we're only changing out the images maybe once or twice a month, it isn't that onerous just to plug in a USB port, copy the picture over, and then run the new slideshow. Maybe for some people, I don't know.
No, it's pretty easy. Okay. Yeah, Raspberry Pis, I mean, if they were originally made, they're about 5 years old now, right? 2012-ish
is
when the first one came out.
I believe so.
They were originally made for schools.
Yeah,
they were supposed to help kids learn programming and customization. And
they were education-based computers.
Yeah, yeah. They're about the size of a credit card. I mean, they're a little bigger than a wallet, basically.
They're about a wallet sized. I have always told people they're like two packs of playing cards stacked on top of one another.
Yeah.
Like that's, when they are in their cases, that is typically how big they are.
And yeah, you just use an SD card on it as your hard drive, and it has a processor built in. It has everything built onto the board.
Some of the models have wireless and Bluetooth capability built directly onto the board.
Yeah, it has a HDMI out and has audio outs. You can do a lot with that.
Yeah. I mean, really, with running Raspbian, which is a full graphic user interfaced operating system, you can go on the internet and you can do word processing if you needed to. Like, you in theory could use this as a standalone computer, but that's really not what people often use them for. They usually use them in tandem with some sort of project.
Yeah, yeah. So what are some of the cooler projects you've seen other than the ones we've already talked about?
Other than making a video game box, which is really kind of slackerish in comparison to what some people do with these. One of the cooler things I've seen is there are additional pieces of hardware that you can plug into the Raspberry Pi, because the Raspberry Pi has what's called a GPIO port, which is essentially like a serial port that you can plug things into that the computer can then control. Essentially what people use that for is like if they wanted to add a camera to the device. So some people have actually turned Raspberry Pis into internet-based security cameras.
Oh yeah, I've seen that before.
Yep. I've seen weather control systems that can take in like weather data, rainfall, wind speeds, all that stuff, and they send that to they can then send that to another computer. They can tweet it, they can store it in a server, they do whatever you want with that data. But it's pretty cool. Some people use them as the computer controls for like robot projects. It's pretty rare, but I have seen it done.
I've seen that before. Things just like a robot arm or like, I don't know, just smaller robotic projects.
Right, something, I mean, it is a computer, so the computer is controlling another device, either through USB or the GPIO port. Something is sending data to something else. It is sending data to something else.
I've seen people make drones with them, like have it as the
the control, yeah. Right. It is the control board. It is what is sending the information, or it is controlling the motors on the drone, as well as maybe processing camera data. I'd imagine they would have to plug something into it if it's like using some sort of gyro sensor as well to stabilize the drone. That's really common, but yeah, they're neat. Wait, didn't one of your friends do something with a Raspberry Pi?
A friend of mine made a planter. So it was basically, He has a Raspberry Pi controlling the water, watering and irrigation and testing soil levels, and just basically has it set up to grow basil in a box indoors. And the Raspberry Pi controls the water pump, so it knows when the soil needs water and then automatically starts bringing water up into it. It controls the lighting, so it turns the lights on and off when they need it. It controls, it actually has a camera hooked up to it and takes a picture and tweets it every hour, so you can kind of see a time lapse of plants growing. And it also tweets things like the soil levels or the, yeah, so it's a really cool project that he put together, and I can link it in the show notes if you want to take a look and see everything that he did. But I think it's pretty cool. I mean, I don't know how much extra stuff he had to buy and work out to get this thing working. But
I mean, looking at that project, I mean, some of it was pretty inexpensive. I mean, like plastic tubs and soil and that sort of thing. But as far as the sensors and things, I'm sure that there's some cost involved. For sure. As a matter of fact, the Raspberry Pi might have been one of the cheaper things in that project. but what's cool is that he probably doesn't have it hooked up to any sort of screen. He probably remotes into the Raspberry Pi to control it and to make any adjustments to the software.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason why a lot of people can make these adjustments is because the operating systems that they're running are all Linux-based. With a couple of exceptions. I think there is a Windows 10.
They have the Internet of Things
version, which is similar, actually, to this watering system, where you use this as a computer to control something in your home. Turning off lights, turning on stoves, setting up robot drones, I don't know, whatever. It can whatever you want it to do to control, as long as it is something that is relatively electrical.
Yeah. There's a lot that you can do with them. I mean, I think the most popular things that people use them for are probably audio or visual projects.
Yes.
I've seen a lot of people make basically a Chromecast with a Raspberry Pi, so you can, yeah, like, cast things from your phone to, yep, your TV, or it as like a jukebox that plays Pandora.
Right. There, I think there's specifically a standalone operating system that works as essentially like a media center PC at that point.
Yeah.
Which I've thought about doing, but that would mean I would have to swap out the SD card whenever I wanted to change operations. But that's one of the great parts is that is literally all I would have to do. Once I plug it in, which essentially turns it on, because there's no on-off switch on the darn thing, and it just boots whatever's on that SD card. So if you wanted to change projects, you just buy another SD card and load up that project.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So one thing I saw, too,
go ahead.
Was someone like made a record player and had it go in connected to a Raspberry Pi, and it could basically broadcast the record to some speakers, so it basically made the record player wireless.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That seems kind of silly to me, but that's because I'm a real...
You're turning something analog digital.
Yeah, well, and I get why people do that if the music that's on the record is not available in any other format. Yeah. And digital has a certain level of convenience that analog equipment doesn't have, as there's a lot to worry about in that regard. But we're spending a lot of time on Raspberry Pis. So, but that is something that is cheap that someone can do and use for projects. Really, anyone could do it, as long as they've got 40. I would say you're probably in the end going to spend about $100. So if you have $100, if you can raise $100, you can probably get this microcomputer, and I'm talking the Raspberry Pi 3, the most powerful, which is still like a 4-core processor and has like a gig of RAM, and it's relatively powerful. It's like an older, power wise it's like a slightly old smartphone, which is pretty good for $40.
Yeah.
Thank you.
the other big movement, the thing I think that a lot of people think of when they think of the makerspace movement are 3D printers, which unfortunately we do not have on this campus. We've talked about it in meetings and stuff. I've even looked at potentially some models that would be worthwhile for us to investigate, but we just don't have...
I'm not sure we have the programs at this time to support something like having a makerspace on campus, but it is something that we're thinking about and looking into for the future.
Yeah, I mean, like a 3D printer is, while cool and has neat projects, I mean, that's really for engineering students. Like, people that are learning some sort of, you know, prototyping or engineering process. Yeah. And there's other applications, but you have to have... You really need it only for engineering, in my opinion. I don't know what else would you use it for in other sciences. I guess you could prototype new equipment for a particular science or experiment, maybe, if there's something that you needed structurally that you can't purchase, and it would be cheaper to just 3D print it.
I mean, think if you have, like... I'll use this as an example. I have a guitar amp, and one of the buttons or knobs fell off.
Right.
I could use a 3D printer and just print a new knob rather than having to go pay money to replace or having to take it in and get it fixed by a professional repair person. Little things like that just around the house. Like,
yeah, but
they're parts that are not easily replicated or found. Being able to just make something to...
But for educational purposes, I think you would really need a program that would utilize it in order to make it worthwhile. If I was at home, I would use it for rapid prototyping. And there are people that use it to make replicas of things. There are people that do use it to make, like, buttons or enclosures out of plastics. Or
game pieces.
Right, yes, people... create prototype board games that they can then sell. I mean, really, it's almost if it's a physical plastic thing that you want to make, most 3D printers can pretty much do it. Not all of them do it well.
Some are better than others. Yeah.
Yes. The big reason why is because typically the cheaper the 3D printer, the bigger the filament it works with. And the bigger the filament, the more gaps there's going to be in the 3D prototype.
Yeah.
There are some 3D printers that use really, really thin plastic filament when they go to print. And it creates really, really like solid pieces that have very little gaps. Or people use acetone bath or another like kind of caustic chemical to kind of melt the plastic a little bit. And so then they can smooth that plastic out and therefore kind of make it, makes it structurally stronger as well, because you're covering over all those gaps. So there's ways around it if you wanted to 3D print something like that, but it's still not perfect.
Yeah.
Certainly.
But they're getting better and they have new models every year, and you know, who knows where 3D printing will be in a few years. Like, I mean, it's getting cheaper, too, to actually purchase the things.
I mean, there are hospitals that are starting to use 3D printers to 3D print organs.
Like scans of people's organs?
Yes. Yeah. So and the reason why they do that is because they can get a much better idea of what is going on with that particular organ and where they would need to make incisions or remove particular pieces of it. So... it makes surgeons better if they can visually see it before they get in there. They spend less time inside the cavity, which makes for a better survival. And also maybe they'll see something that they didn't expect to see, and you can't see it because it's on like the back end of the heart, you know, toward the placement toward the back. There's a story, if I recall correctly, of a child being saved in a heart surgery because the surgeon utilized a 3D printer to print out the child's heart to get better insight on the heart. And it probably took a day. I don't know how long it takes to print something like that. I mean, that's part of the problem is that...
It does take a while. Yeah. Hours to days, depending on the quality and if it could fail halfway through and you could have to restart.
A lot of people print the stuff in pieces and then assemble them.
Yeah. Another big thing right now is it's giving people the ability to make custom artificial prosthetics. Limbs.
Oh, that stuff is cool.
Much, much cheaper than through the old methods. So that's an up-and-coming use for 3D printers.
It's a very disrupting technology. Yeah. I mean, in general, like the concept of the 3D printer disrupts all sorts of industries. And I mean, that's a perfect example of its ability to change really the world of power that exists with these companies that have the money to make these items. So that's why prosthetics cost so darn much, is because it takes a lot of effort to make something like that. It has to be safe. And you have to recoup all that engineering cost. I mean,
for something that is fitted, form-fitted to someone's specific body, like, that takes custom work that the old methods would take a lot of time and money, like thousands upon thousands of dollars to make an artificial limb.
Right, or they were very ill-fitting.
Yeah. So having these custom, and some of them are very elegant. I've seen some very... like fancy, very attractive artificial limbs that people made with 3D printers.
Like very latticed.
Yeah.
And
it's almost like a statement, or like someone would wear it as a fashion statement.
Right. It's really impressive. I think I wonder if then that is going to lead to people including more robotics inside of those limbs, just because they can.
I mean, it's happened a little bit already. I know that my brother-in-law is a teacher at OPS, and I know that a couple years ago, I think it was 1 or 2 years ago, one of his students who had lost an arm was gifted a Iron Man arm,
I think it
was. Yeah, and it was a robotic 3D printed arm.
Oh, that's cool.
I think there was a big story in the World Herald about that. Or
not surprised. I think I kind of remember that. That's pretty neat. I mean, who wouldn't want that? If you got to lose your arm, might as well get a robot arm. Am I right? Yeah. If it's got to be a robot arm, should probably be the good old Iron Man arm, which is not a robot necessarily. It's armor. I get it. Calm down.
I did find the story for that, so I will link it in the.
Okay, good.
I will link it in the show notes if you want to see that.
Hey, that's. So, I mean, yeah, 3D printers, they're super neat. I don't know, a lot of times with the maker movement, it's people using kind of the technology that's around us, technology that is easily accessible to create new and interesting things. Sometimes that requires people to kind of move out of the realms of legality, I think, in some regard, at least certainly to copyright. So, in regards to copyright.
Well, there's a big sharing culture when it comes to 3D printable items, too.
Yeah,
I know
that's
there's
true.
Multiple websites where you can just go on and browse their entire like catalog of designs.
Yeah.
Thingiverse is one big one.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, it might go around legality in some ways, but people are adapting and, you know, just making things open source. And, I mean, there's...
Or utilizing Creative Commons if it's not in like logos and stuff you got to be really careful with, because a company owns that logo or that item.
Well, if you're trying to make something that looks exactly and functions exactly like a known product,
you might get
in trouble.
You might get in trouble, but... especially if you try to sell it.
Yeah.
If you don't try to sell it, that you may be able to argue fair use. It just depends. I mean, like I said, this is a very disrupting technology, so this could cause a lot of issues with toy manufacturers, this could cause issues with, like, these prosthetic companies, like, all this stuff. If they're using something that's similar to a product they already have, that they can show, like, is clearly being used, that their intellectual property is being used to make money, then you run the risk of getting sued. not to scare anyone off of this, it's highly unlikely. Just don't be a moron and just like 3D scan Batman symbol without altering it in some way.
What else?
I mean, the other big factor, I think, is audiovisual equipment that's being used in makerspaces. I really like that idea because microphones and soundboards, computer software, instruments, all that stuff is super expensive. And if you want to be able to produce music or make videos, something along those lines, if you don't have the equipment, if you don't have the ability to purchase the equipment, then you run the risk of whatever you want to make looking very amateurish and being ignored by the masses. I mean, yes, there are times where videos that are produced on YouTube or go viral, and then so people have like a viral video for, you know, a week and it gets play, but then after that it kind of dies down. I think that having these makerspace video audiovisual spaces allows people that would never have the opportunity to make content for the internet be able to produce this content. In some ways, I think that's kind of what libraries, that more than anything else, is a concept that I think really lends strength to the library message of kind of being able to better yourself and having the facilities to do so.
Yeah, having the facilities and the equipment that, you know, obviously I can't afford any of this stuff. So having a place to go to where I could use it would be incredibly helpful.
Yeah. Not a lot of library. I mean, there are some libraries that have these things. They have video cameras and green screens and software that allows you to manipulate that. They have soundboards and computers. Like some do have this equipment, but it's just not ubiquitous. Most people, if they want to create a quote unquote makerspace, they just buy a 3D printer. Done. There, we did it. We made a makerspace. And I think they're missing the point, I think, when they do that. I mean, a makerspace could be, like we said earlier, a wood shop. A makerspace could be, you know, circuit boards and soldering irons. I mean, it can be anything where you as a hobbyist create something. So probably the last thing that we'll touch on is it's kind of tangentially tied to 3D printers, but that would be laser cutters. This sort of stuff has existed for a long time.
They're very, very cool. You can do a lot of stuff with the laser cutter, like custom engraving, or you can cut and shape metal with a laser cutter if you have a powerful enough one. Generally, wood burning and paper art and things like that are the probably more used.
Yeah. But
if you have...
I think a lot of people use it also for plexiglass.
Yeah.
And or some sort of plastic cutting. And I think that allows people to also do rapid prototyping of some sort. But it's not... You aren't working off of like a 3D image. You're more using it to cut out these pieces and then assemble them yourself.
Yeah, you're kind of designing a flat image. So this is where engravings kind of come in. And the laser cutter just cuts out whatever the shape that you want on it. So whatever material you use, whether it be like plexiglass or wood, it'll just cut through, and you can set it less powerful if you just want to do like engraving in wood, which I know a lot of, you get a... There's all sorts of things you can make with that. Like, you can engrave GIFs and, you know, engrave... a lot of people on Etsy, I see, sell this kind of stuff. And engraved wood, like, things that you put up on the wall.
They're often referred to as, like, CNC machines.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, is essentially like a laser cutter. Like, they allow you to cut out or carve into a surface, and then you do something with it, so... Yeah.
So if you're making a box, you could have it cut the box, basically cut each panel of the box, and then you could just put it together yourself.
It's one of the pieces of the pie, because a 3D printer isn't going to do that sort of work quickly and efficiently. It's going to waste a lot of filament, it's not going to look very good, and it's not going to be very structurally sound if it's laying down panels or trying to create this box in a 3D environment. Maybe you want to be able to open or shut or alter the box in some way. So you would need to add in some sort of hardware or modify the design in some way so that you can connect pieces of it together. There's reasons to use that versus a 3D printer. It really comes down to it's in some ways it's like a wood shop having a bandsaw. Like you are literally cutting a relatively lengthwise piece of material so that you can do something with it.
And the nice thing about it is it basically does it automatically. Like you just have to have the design loaded up on the computer connected to it, and it will cut out whatever shape in whatever dimensions you input into it.
And
so
yeah,
most of the design actually takes place on the computer. You feed it to it and then it just does it. So whereas if I was actually like, I feel much more comfortable designing in like Photoshop or in just
some
using,
other photo
using computer
stuff.
Programs yeah. to edit things than actually trying to use my hands. If I had to use a wood burner, like a handheld one, to yeah. do an engraving, it would look terrible. But if I did it in Photoshop with a fancy font and then just loaded it onto the computer and had it printed out, it would look exactly like it does in my Photoshop design.
Yeah. The other thing is precision.
Yeah.
There is a level of precision with a laser cutter than exists with the human hand. And these are, you know, laser cutting is used in medical science. And, you know, it's a handheld, you know, kind of laser knife that's able to, you know, close sutures and you know, seal any sort of blood flow. This technology is being used outside of fabrication, but it is all part of that fabrication world. There are a lot of projects that I would like to have access to this stuff. And thankfully, in the city of Omaha, there is a location that has most of the stuff, which is the Dew Space. And I recently went to the Dew Space to while I was working on my comprehensive testing for my degree in library science. And I saw these great giant 3D printers and laser cutting machines. And, you know, they had these cool breakdown labs for kids. Like they turned what was quoted as a classroom into a computer lab and then instantly was able to turn it back into just desks. I mean, I saw that classroom when it had all the computers in it. I'm like, oh, this is another computer lab. And I show up the next day and all that stuff is just kind of magically put away. So I was really impressed by their facilities, as well as some of the projects that people were working on. People were legitimately working on some of these maker projects.
Yeah, I've been thinking of going in there to make some wedding favors because I'm working on planning my wedding right now.
Well, what's cool, and I know this, because we actually have someone on staff, Caitlin Lombardo, who works there as part-time staff and does education sessions and tours and stuff like that. So, I mean, she's not like a volunteer. She actually does work for Dew Space. And I know she's told me that really, if you wanted to 3D print something, once you have your card, you can just send the file to them. And then pick it up. That's how convenient this their services are. And of course, now it's not for free because you need to pay for the filament that you use. And I don't know if they charge any sort of surcharge on top of that, maybe to cover electricity. The cost for the filament is relatively low, so it's not a huge burden. To the person that wants to do this stuff. So yeah, Joel, if you wanted to do that, just go get your card. You got to get all signed up and everything. And then after that, you just send them the files. You don't even need to like spend a lot of time in the building.
Nice. Well, very cool. So this is a topic that is kind of evergreen right now in libraries. It's very popular conference topics.
It's kind of kitschy. Like, I don't know. I don't know how long this quote-unquote movement is going to last. There is a lot of things that are preventing, that are starting to hinder this movement. Like, the right to repair is a current law in Nebraska that's being fought over, and that could have an impact on makerspaces if people wanted to use them for repair purposes. It has a little bit more to do with manufacturers supporting their products with repair pieces and manuals, but it maybe in a roundabout way it could affect that. And also, once these get cheap enough for every home to have them, they're not going to require quite the buying power that like a public or academic library has when it comes to municipal funds. So we may see, just like how libraries were one of the early places to access the internet when the internet was super expensive, maybe the maker movement will move more into the home.
It'll become more ubiquitous and a personal level.
Right. And, yeah. You know, the joke is that eventually you will purchase just a fabrication machine. And then when you buy something, you're really just buying a digital file. And like maybe the number of times.
Very Star Trek.
It is very Star Trek.
Yeah,
but
our replicator.
Yeah, the replicators in Star Trek are literally creating matter from carbon. Like they're.
We're not there yet.
No, that is science fiction for sure at this point. And I don't know if that's ever going to be science fact. There is a certain level of true concepts in it. So there's certain aspects of physics that ring true when it comes to the concept, but the science is so advanced. I don't know if we'll certainly never see it in our lifetimes, but we'll probably see these 3D printers in homes printing off stuff. So who knows?
Well, I think that's about all the time we have today, but that's maker spaces and libraries.
Yep. It is, and we maybe someday we'll see one here. I don't know. It really depends. There's talk. Come up with some programs, guys.
Keep on creating.
That's right.
Keep on making.